Hi there, we really hope you enjoy this teaching from the Message Trust. To find out more about all the exciting things we're doing, check out our website, message.org.uk.
Great to be here. Let me just say a little bit about myself before we kind of jump into this subject, and whilst people come with their coffees and all those sort of things and join us as well. It's a good excuse for me to introduce myself. So my name's Ian. I moved to Manchester with my wife, Jen, 16 years ago. And that was to be part of the Message. We were pioneering one of the new Eden teams back then in a place called Harper Hay, which was awesome. We still live there, same house, still massively committed to that community. I spent around about 6 years or so part of that Eden team, and then we kind of changed roles slightly, and I became the exec director of mission here at The Message and did that role for about 6 years as well. So have spent a long time as part of The Message family, and it is a privilege to be here. And and then, totally to my surprise really, moved on from The Message to start this project called Naked Truth, which aims to open eyes and free lives from the damaging impact of porn. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't sit down with my careers advisor at school and kind of run that one past them, you know. When I'm hit about 40, I'm thinking I'm going to leave a job I love and an organisation that I've loved being part of to start a porn project. It wasn't part of the plan. I think even today, as I sat this morning in that amazing session that we just had, I was kind of almost saying to myself, why did I do that again? What was that about? Because this is such a great vision, isn't it? It's so, so brilliant to be here and to be part of the vision that The Message has been running with for these last 25 years. And yet also I know this. I know that a huge part of what we're trying to do with Naked Truth just dovetails into that vision. I guess I always knew that porn was out there. I always knew it was an issue. I kind of saw it, though, as probably one of those things that some people struggle with sometimes. You know, it was something that maybe at an event, someone might come forward and they might ask, you know, very quietly for some prayer about. It was something maybe I saw some of the people around me perhaps struggling with. But I'll be honest, it wasn't a cause. You know, it wasn't a thing that I felt was worth, you know, fighting for. It wasn't something I was going to give my life to. But a couple of things happened 10 years ago that have totally changed how I view pornography. It's totally changed my understanding of it. And I won't just be talking about pornography in this session, because this is obviously, we're going to just talk about this whole generation and the huge impact that sex as a whole has had. But I wanted to start really with my story and I guess my journey. As I said, I think 10 years ago, two significant things happened. One was extremely public, and everyone's heard about it. And one was much more kind of private and personal to me. So 10 years ago, on a Californian stage, a guy in a black roll neck jumper stood up and 10 years ago said, "Today, Apple is going to reinvent the phone." And he held aloft like this, the first ever iPhone. And from that moment, so much changed. So much changed. Because the internet, that had already become a bit of a game changer in terms of pornography, suddenly left people's desktops and now was in people's hands and pockets and purses. One website last year, one porn website reported having 23 billion visits in a year. Just get your head around that for a second. 23 billion visits. So that works out around about 60 million visits a day, which is double what YouTube get in a day. So this porn site is without question one of the biggest websites out there. you know, and it means that this generation that we're talking about wanting to reach, this is the first generation with any time, anywhere access to unregulated content. Porn has never been more accessible, more anonymous, which is a word I struggle to say, which is a bit of an occupational hazard because I have to say it a lot. It's never been so addictive or affordable. You know that website I just talked about? Free. Everything's free. So that actually means young people who maybe before would have needed a credit card or needed to convince a shopkeeper that they were 18 before they could have access to adult content. Now they can just go on a website, and at the moment, although there's some, you know, there's a desire to try and change some of this, but at the moment they just got to tick a box that says yes, I'm over 18 on this, governor. So we are seeing a completely different landscape, and what we will look at and think about a little bit this afternoon is how actually that landscape is impacting young people in our churches, young people in our culture more generally, and actually it's become a huge obstacle for people to be able to know Jesus and to know themselves as Jesus would want them to. And so that's one of the reasons why Naked Truth started, actually, because of this change in landscape. And God, just as Danielle was talking, you know, God began to, in some ways, open my eyes to that and enable me to actually see this huge shift that was happening. The other thing that happened 10 years ago that was much less public was a very personal thing, and that was my dad got arrested. And my dad was involved in church. He was a sort of leader in church stuff. He was a CEO of a Christian organization. And then one day the police came to his workplace and they arrested him because a colleague had found indecent images of children on his computer. And for us as a family, that was when we discovered for the first time, really, that my dad had hidden decades of porn use, most of which had been legal and had been the sort of stuff that most people are looking at every day. But towards the end, became something that he crossed one line and then another line, and it spiraled, and eventually he started to download and consume that terrible material that he was arrested for, and that abusive, horrible stuff. And those two things are really significant in me realizing that sex, pornography in particular, it's something that's always been there. It's always been an issue. It's like when it comes to the kingdom, it's an old enemy actually, but there's new weapons. And that's something that we need to pay attention to. Now, even as I say that, let me clarify. I hope I don't need to, and I'm kind of making some assumptions. I'm assuming that you don't have an issue with sex, that you think sex is a good thing, that sex is something beautiful, actually, and it's something that God has given us, and it is a beautiful gift to his creation. But I'm also going to assume, and we're not going to talk about this today, I'm going to assume that you probably recognize that lust, that selfish desires, that adultery, that, you know, to use an old word, fornication, you know, the sex outside of marriage, that things like pornography, that all those things are things that Jesus does have a problem with, that they are a less than the gift that he's given us, that they are often a hollow and counterfeit version of the beautiful gift of sex that is for us to enjoy. And so I'm going to make those assumptions. Is that okay? Because otherwise we could do a whole kind of different seminar right now. And so I'm going to assume that we're on the same page here, that we think sex is brilliant, that sex is a good thing, but this kind of corrupt, distorted, warped often version of sex that is displayed in things like pornography and then perhaps lived out in the lives of so many people is something that we actually want to do something about, that we want to address. Me and my wife, Jen, we we went to the National Slavery Museum a couple of years ago. I don't know if you've ever been. It's in Liverpool, so it's not far from here. And they changed the exhibitions a lot, obviously, and I don't even know if they still have this now. But when we walked around, they were kind of showing little kind of architectural kind of models of all the beautiful buildings that there are in Liverpool. And there's kind of like, you know, these grand buildings that we know. Some are really famous that are kind of in the Dockland area there, and the Liver building and all those sort of, so, but also some of the other buildings that are in the centre of Liverpool, these great, grand, amazing buildings. And they talked a little bit, as you looked at the buildings, of the people who had funded those buildings and maybe what their original purpose has been. You know, now it's probably an insurance company's office, but it used to be something really brilliant. So they talked about, for example, this building used to be a school. And it was a school, and it was built as a school for street children. And we looked at it and said, oh, that's amazing, imagine that. And they described how the area that it had been built in was actually slums, really. Like a lot of Manchester used to be. It was just kind of like pretty much slum area, people living in extreme poverty. But some amazing Christian people got a heart to transform not only that community in a very physical way, but also in a spiritual way, transform the lives of the people living in that community by bringing education, free education, education for people who couldn't get education any other way. And we remember we read about that building and about actually, and it said these were Christian people. That's what it said in this museum. These Christian people that wanted to do some gospel transformation by building a school for in this deprived area. And we were like going, yes, this is awesome. And then it said, and those individuals, those generous-hearted, kingdom-minded people, funded that building through the slave trade. Because they made their money through maybe the sugar industry that was basically built on the back of slaves across the ocean. Or maybe even they bought and sold slaves themselves as part of their business. And that money they made was the same money that they used to build this beautiful kingdom thing. And it was kind of like making my brain go a little bit, how does that work? And then I read another one so similar, like just in the next room, another building. And there it was, this amazing building, and we'd seen it that day as we'd walked past it, and he said this was built as a missionary society, a building where people were gathered and trained to go out and preach the gospel to all nations. And it was like, wow, that's amazing. And there's no doubt that was Christians. Without question, Christians came up with that idea, because who else would send out people to preach the gospel to all the nations? And again, it said that this building was funded by the slave industry. And as we drove home, Jen, my wife, she said this, because she's probably smarter than me. She said, because I remember just going, how could they not see it? What was wrong with these people? These amazing Christians, they obviously had such incredible heart. How did they miss something that was so corrupt, so warped, so not of the kingdom? How could you hold those two things together so easily? Here I am wanting to build a school for street kids. Here I am wanting to build a missionary center send out people to preach the gospel, and yet all my money is coming from the slave trade. How can you have that kind of next to each other like that in our lives? I couldn't understand the mindset or the people. And Jen just said, I wonder what in 200 years time the future church and future Christians will look back on and say, how did they not see that? They were brilliant. Look at all the amazing stuff they were doing, but how did they miss something so obvious? And I think the answer to that question, certainly for them 200 years ago, the Christians of that time, was that slavery was so systemic. It was so part of everyday life. It was so part of culture. It was so everything that they saw and did, and it was almost impossible for them to see. Perhaps maybe because they were a little bit so removed from it, you know, all the pain, all the suffering, all the brokenness, it was kind of happening over the ocean. They didn't actually have the proximity to it to actually recognize how bad it was. Maybe that was what it was. Or maybe it was just so normalized. Maybe it's just like everybody I know has a slave. It's just how things are. It's just how it is. that they couldn't even see it. And I bring that up today because I wonder if our culture faces an issue that we're almost blinded to because it's become so normalized to us. That our culture faces an issue that is so systemic, so much part of what we live and breathe in. But then also at the same time, that the brokenness and the darkness of it is something we're quite removed from and insulated from, almost at the same time. Does that make sense? That we can be immersed in something and yet at the same time not have a clue what's really going on, which is, I think, what happened 200 years ago. And I would argue today that one of the reasons why we've got to talk about an issue like pornography is because it's almost impossible for us to see it. But I wonder if when the Christians of 200 years look back on us, they'll go, oh my goodness, how did they miss that one? And I remember, before I tell you this story, let me show you a little video. This, because if you need convincing that our society has become immersed in something, that if we're not, maybe we can see it, maybe our faith helps us see it, but they certainly can't. If you want convincing of that, let's just watch this little video together.
The first time I watched porn, I think I was 13.
I think when I was about 12.
Maybe 13, 14.
15.
I was about 11.
Probably about 12.
Yeah. 12, yeah.
I was probably about 10, maybe.
I know I have loads of friends that watch porn for pleasure.
Of course, I liked it. Something new.
It's really easy.
It's really easy to find porn now. Just type into Google whatever you like.
I think I was shocked at first because I had never seen anything explicit before.
We'd never seen sex.
All my friends watch it and talk about it, and that's been since I was 11.
I think everyone I've dated has watched porn.
Like, we're in a generation now where it is normal, porn is normal, and everyone watches it.
I think, like, watching porn does become a part of, like, sex education for the younger generation, yeah. More so.
My personal experience, I definitely learned a lot from porn.
It's like a manual. Watching porn is like a manual, I suppose.
That's the whole point of it, really, to then take that video and then, you know, do it on a bird. That's the aim.
I think guys are thinking they're learning about sex, watching porn.
At least once a day, at least.
There was a stage where I was three times a day, really, three, four times a day.
3 to 4 times a week, I'd say.
At least once a week, I guess, or something like that.
That's news to me.
I was addicted to it when I first got into it.
Like, I come home from school, put porn on.
From there, more porn. That's it, it just escalated.
So, I remember maybe a year or so after everything had happened with my dad, I was on a kind of retreat time. I was kind of spending some time on my own, and I was reading through scripture, and I remember I began to read Proverbs 9. I don't know if you know it. If you've got, you know, something on your phone, it might even be worth you kind of getting it out, because we're going to spend a little bit of time today talking about Proverbs 9. And it talks about this. It talks about a woman called wisdom. And those of you that know Proverbs will know that wisdom, kind of as a person, this personification of wisdom as a woman, kind of occurs throughout Proverbs. But in Proverbs 9, it describes how she has prepared a meal. And so we'll look at that. Let me just get it up as well, and I'll actually read it to you word for word as you find it too. Proverbs 9. There we go. It says this: wisdom has built her house. She has set up its 7 pillars. She has prepared her meat and mixed her wine. She's also set her table. She has sent out her servants, and she calls from the highest point of the city, "Let all who are simple come to my house." To those who have no sense, she says, "Come, eat my food and drink the wine I have mixed. Leave your simple ways and you will live. Walk in the way of insight." And I remember kind of reading these verses, and at the time I was working for The Message. My job was to try and think about how do we help people hear the good news in a way that makes sense to them and captivates them, and how do we do that? And I remember reading this kind of description of Proverbs 9 and this banquet and this idea of wine and food. And actually this is imagery that Scripture has used throughout the Bible again, and we'll know that Isaiah 24 talks about, uses almost exactly the same words that are in Proverbs 9, where it says that God is on a mountain and he prepares a feast and he uses the finest meats and the best wine, and he invites the broken and the kind of disillusioned and the hopeless to come and be part of this feast that he has prepared on this mountain. God himself is doing that in Isaiah. In Proverbs, it's wisdom who, again, often as we kind of look back at Proverbs, we understand that wisdom is Jesus. That as we read about wisdom in Proverbs, we're reading about Jesus. And of course, Jesus himself uses this language of a feast and of a banquet when he wants people to know what life can be like. He'll say that I've come to give you life and life in all its abundance, and he'll use that. But he'll say, the kingdom of God is like a feast. It's like a banquet, and you're invited to be part of it. And the people who think they're uninvited, they are not. They're actually included, and all this stuff. So this language of the feast, of the banquet, of Proverbs preparing a banquet, represents in Scripture the idea of God having something beautiful, something wonderful, that all can be part of it, that it's meant to be abundant, it's meant to be the best, it's kingdom, it's heaven, it's all that stuff that we love. It's salvation and transformation. So I'm reading Proverbs 9, and I'm reading about that, and I'm reading how in Proverbs, wisdom, she starts calling out to people, doesn't she? And she says, leave your ways, leave your simple ways, your confused ways, and live the life that you're meant to have. And I remember being on this retreat and praying and saying, yes, Lord, that's what I want. That's what I want for the message. That's what I want for my life. That's what we're all about. How do we do that? And I was reading how it said that she went to the highest place in the city. Did you spot that? It said that wisdom, she prepares the meal, she sends out her servants, but then she goes out as well. And it says she goes to the highest point in the city. That was really the place where she could be seen and heard most clearly. It was the busiest road. It was the bustling place. It was Times Square. It was, the Albert Square in the Christmas markets. It was where there was maybe too many people. It was the highest, busiest part of the city. And that's where she says, hey, I've got something good. Leave your ways and live and experience this transformation. And I remember even then, thinking about it now, going, Lord, okay, what does it look like for us, your people, the church, the Message Trust, who I was working for? What does it look like for us to go to the highest place? What does that mean? How can we get to a place where we can be seen and heard and be visible and clear to everybody who's walking past? How can we give this invitation to people? Is it through music? Yes, it is. For young people, that's an awesome way of doing it. Is it by living next door to them in the most deprived communities? Of course it is. Yeah, let's do that. That's how we're going to do it. That's like being in the highest place. And I'm praying and I'm getting excited and I'm getting fired up. And this is all good for me. But then I carry on reading Proverbs 9, because it doesn't just talk about wisdom. It introduces a second person into Proverbs 9, which is another woman who is folly. And it says this. It says, verse 13, folly is an unruly woman. She is simple and knows nothing. She sits at the door of her house on a seat at the highest point of the city, calling out to those who pass by, who go straight on their way, let all who are simple come into my house. To those who have no sense, she says, stolen water is sweet. Food eaten in secret is delicious. But little do they know that the dead are there, that her guests are deep in the realm of the dead. And I remember reading those words so clearly. And I remember reading about, first of all, that folly is this woman who lives in the highest place in the city. And I remember just going, I've just spent half an hour asking God, how do we get to the highest place in the city? And this person, folly, and what she represents, this is her home turf. this is where she just steps out of her door, sits on her steps, and she's there. Because this is where she lives. And then her invitation to all who are simple, come into my house. Come in. It's not, you don't have to go on a long journey. Wisdom's house is all the way over there. Just come in. It's right here. It's right here. No distance at all. It's instant. Come on in. And what you get if you come in, I'll tell you what you get. Food eaten in secret is delicious. And stolen water is sweet. I remember reading it, and it's not the first time I would have read it, but it was the first time for me that I heard the enticement of porn and sex, you know, that, as we describe, sort of broken sex. And I thought, yeah, that's the invitation my dad listened to time and time again. Food eaten in secret is delicious. Stolen water is sweet. But then I also noticed right at the end, and I knew this was truth as well, I also noticed that it was a bait and switch situation. That the chapter ends with this idea, but what her guests do not know is that in her house is the realm of death. And I think God began to help me understand something, that he wants people to experience the banquet. He wants people to experience a life transformed and a life of abundance. And as Jesus said, I've come to give you life and life in its fullness. But literally a breath before, he said, but the thief comes to kill, steal, and destroy. And the truth is, and one that we have got to come to terms with, is that there are two invitations going on in our culture. There is an invitation for something beautiful and brilliant, a banquet, a gospel invitation, but there is also other invitations that folly has an invitation to, and that it leads to death. It leads to destruction. It leads to broken lives and emptiness. Almost the opposite of the banquet. And I certainly have seen time and time and time and time again how pornography and broken sexual relationships lead to those things. And I've seen time and time again great Christian people fall by the wayside because of pornography and broken sexual relationships. I've seen time and time again people who would have grabbed hold of the gospel, but it just seemed a little bit too difficult and a little bit too far when there's this thing right here, right now, this relationship I'm in, or this opportunity I've got to satisfy my desires and kind of self-soothe and have a quick fix. So maybe I don't need total transformation after all. And maybe you see that too. Maybe you can think of those people too. And so as we think about how do we reach and release an over-sexed generation, part of what I think we've got to do is look at these two women of folly and of wisdom, because I think we'll find some answers there. Those of us that are trying to reach out to those outside the church, and we recognize, actually, let's be honest, sex is massive, even if they don't see it because they're so immersed. It's a massive obstacle, a huge mountain. You know, Isaiah 40, one of the charity I started, our kind of foundational verses come from Isaiah 40, where it says, prepare a way for the Lord, level mountains and lift valleys so that the glory of the Lord can be revealed to all flesh. And the reason why those verses matter to me is because it helps me understand that my desire is that Jesus is revealed to all flesh. But sometimes we have to deal with the mountains and the valleys that are in the way. Sometimes we've got to actually say there is something blocking the way, and we can prepare the way for Jesus by getting rid of it. Sometimes it's something missing in people's lives. There's a valley, there's a chasm that needs to be restored and filled in so that people can connect with Jesus and see who he is. You know, yes, we want to be people that are revealing Jesus, but sometimes we have to prepare a way to enable that to happen. You know, those same words are the words that Martin Luther King spoke in Washington in his famous I Had a Dream speech. He quoted those same Isaiah 40 verses because he too could see that just racism and segregation was this mountain that needed to be leveled so that actually, hopefully, people become the people that they're created to be, both in their relationship with God and with one another. And so sometimes we've got to address this stuff, haven't we? And so when we talk about this, this isn't like, oh yeah, well, we've got a problem with sex and we don't like it. What we're talking about actually is gospel stuff, because if we don't address these mountains, if we don't seek to level the mountains and lift the valleys, then actually sometimes for some people, they can't see Jesus unless we do. That's part of our role of making disciples, is that we've got to deal with that stuff. And some of you are right in the center of that, because maybe a mountain for you is poverty or addiction in another area. Or, you know, maybe it's you're working with a fatherless generation and you see this huge chasm, this huge thing that is missing in people's lives that just seems to constantly get in the way of them being able to connect with God. We understand it, actually, don't we? And so what we're going to do in the time that I've got left is we're going to look a little bit at how we can specifically think about sex, broken sex, and pornography, and what we can do. And I would say the first thing that we do with Naked Truth is that we're trying to be deliberate about naming pornography for what it is. It's kind of like the story of the emperor's new clothes, you know, where everyone's kind of bought into this thing, maybe because they don't want to look stupid, maybe because whatever reason, but it takes someone to go, hang on a minute, isn't our boss walking around with no clothes on? And sometimes you have to kind of really name what you see. And one of the ways that we're trying to do that is we want to name pornography for what it is, which is folly. We want to display that and show that and articulate that. Not just say, oh, porn is bad, let's get a placard. But actually articulate why it's folly. Why it leads to death and destruction. I'm going to show you a video now that a friend of ours has made that we're going to be launching in probably about 2 or 3 weeks. And this is for unchurched people. This is something that we're using as part of our way of saying, let's show people what folly looks like. And as we deconstruct their understanding of maybe the things that they're kind of involved in, that enables us then to start to talk about something better and more beautiful, which I'll get onto. But let's just listen to this together. So this is by our friend called Joshua Luke Smith.
I remember when I first met you. I'm not even gonna lie to you. The moment I laid eyes on you, I was hypnotized by you. As I looked down at your thighs, all I could think about was the things that I might do if I could be alone with you. At home, on my own with you. And so I started to get bold with you, acting like I was older too. Every time we got together and such. And yeah, you told me you were tender. But I knew you had a venomous touch. Cause I felt way out of my depth, yet it was never enough. And so I just kept coming back for that adrenaline rush. And we got together daily. You taught me to see the world differently. You took my childish naivety, held my eyes over the fire till you burnt away my desire for mystery. And yeah, I knew that you were dangerous. Cause when I told people I was seeing you, they told me to keep my distance. I just thought they couldn't see what I could see in you. Cause you were always there when I needed you. Told me the other girls weren't good enough and I could only get what I need from you. And that I'd never find a relationship worth its cost or complication. So I should make self-gratification my pursuit and destination. But as days turned into weeks and weeks into months, I started to get frustrated. Despite your talk and your temptation, your body without blemish and pixel perfect presentation. I never once left your presence without the sense of being vacant. like a house that no one lives in. Every time I would submit to your seduction, I was sentenced to a prison with bricks made out of lust and an infiltrated vision where I could only ever see women as beings built for my seduction but unwilling in their submission. I was blinded by your beauty, too naive to see that you had the power to ruin me and pull apart my family. That was until I found a reality that has crucified my fantasy. And that's all that you ever were. Did I tell you I met a girl? She's my wife now, and you'll never be anything but a shell of her. That's the reason that it's been a while. That's the reason that we don't talk at all. That's the reason I can't even look at you or pick up despite the times you call. Cause all you ever had to tempt me with was the desire to take a fix that would distract me from a brokenness that could only ever heal with patience, relationship, discipline, and a whole lot of devotedness. And yet I saw a friend recently. They said that they've been seeing you now. And I can't let you leave another person bent double, beaten and bleeding out. I know it's taken me some time, but I'm finally speaking out. Cause your strength is fashioned in the shadows, but you are not a secret now. Your name is Pawn. Yeah, you take many forms, but you do nothing but wrong. For in the heart of every human is the authentic desire to connect and to belong. Now, I've discovered over the years that intimacy is our most natural song, and all you've ever been is muted screams behind computer screens that deny, delay, and defute the dreams of being loved by someone. I regret the days we spent together and how I let you corrupt my mind with your image. But the story isn't over. I have a life, a future. It's beautiful, and you're not in it.
It's good that, isn't it? I'm still trying to decide whether to warn people that it's his letter to Pawn and him dumping Pawn, or whether it's better for people to discover it at the end. Yeah, I think the reveal is more powerful, but you might spend the hype. But it'll be online, but then you miss some of the power of what he says, I think, as well, before the reveal. So it'll be online soon, and you can maybe watch it again, and kind of, it's powerful words, and out of his own experience as well. Just, again, this sense of recognizing why it just doesn't work. It doesn't work. I want us to try and help people ask some questions. If we're going to help them, if we're going to name folly for what it is, then we need to help them actually question it, you know, to actually question what they're surrounded by. You know, one of the ways I think we can do that is, one of the things we do in school, for example, so Naked Truth, part of our work is that we talk about pornography in schools. And one of the things that we do is we talk about junk food, and we say how we can crave junk food, but actually we kind of probably know it's not great for us as well. But we say there's probably three questions that junk food companies don't want us to ask. And I'll be honest, if I go to a kebab shop tonight, it's a Friday night, it's highly possible. You know, I stand in front of that lump of meat turning slowly in front of what looks like my nan's gas heater. And I ask any of these three questions, maybe, just maybe, I'll think again. You know, this first question, is this good for me? You know, it's like, I'm just, yeah, is it good for my health? What's in this? Because there doesn't seem to be as many cats around in our neighborhood as there used to be. You know, How was this made? Do you remember when Jamie Oliver did the whole school dinners thing and he kind of showed kids the way that the nuggets and stuff that they loved for school dinners were made? And he basically said, look, none of the good meat's in these. It's the leftover carcasses that get blended up, and then we chuck a load of stuff in, and this gets washed in ammonia, which is basically bleach. And then we put all this stuff around in some nice breadcrumbs and fry them up, and there you go. And because they watched it, they were like going, oh my word, that's horrible. These three questions actually are so important, particularly for us as we talk about pornography. You know, is this good for me? More and more we're getting scientific research being published that shows how addictive pornography is, the way it impacts the brain in the same way that, a substance drug can actually, how it causes escalation. So things that used to give you a high don't give you a high anymore. So you need more of it or a more extreme version of it just to have the same experience, the same arousal, the same hit as before, just like drugs do. How you build up tolerance, how actually it even causes things like erectile dysfunction in men in their 20s. Yes, I just said erectile dysfunction at a Christian conference. That's what I get to do with my job. But it's true. NHS are just kind of coming to, like, we've got team who are psychotherapists and things like that, are coming to our team saying, can you go into universities and start talking about this stuff? Because we're inundated by guys in their 20s with porn-induced erectile dysfunction. The only time that they'll have an erection is if they're watching porn and that is it. That is not a moral thing or an ethical thing that's happening. That's a very physical thing that is happening to them, and that people are more and more understanding about porn. What about this question? What's in this? That's a huge question, isn't it? You know, again, with young people, one of the things we'll often say is, what's in it is fake. What's in it is hollow and counterfeit. What in it is not educational. You remember those kids saying, that's how I learn about sex and relationships, is by watching porn? You know, something I'll say is, you know, when you want to pass your driving test, if the only learning you've done is watching James Bond car chases, you're going to have a problem, because they might be exciting to watch and entertaining and they make a shed load of money for the producers, but they're not attempting to educate you how to drive. And porn is doing exactly the same thing. Porn's only interest is money. The porn industry wants to make money. They are not interested in portraying something that is ethical or realistic. Now, there's a whole conversation you could say, well, what about ethical porn? I've heard about and read about ethical porn. But in the end, it's an industry making money. And so they don't care if it's unrealistic. They don't even claim for it be realistic. But the problem is that unreal fake world seeps into the real world, and it affects us and how we see ourselves and how we see our body shape and how we see our partners and the people that we love and the people that maybe walk around and work with us that we start objectifying, because that fake world actually impacts the real world. So what's in it is fake, but it is impacting us in very real ways. And then this final question, well, how was it made? That's a challenging question. Especially when we start understanding that big website I talked about with the 23 billion visits in a year, it works like YouTube, and you have categories and genres, and the most popular search terms are teen and stepmom, and you know, just stuff that you're going, hang on a minute. And then you start to find out that actually more and more people's tastes are evolving and changing, where people want more and more violent and aggressive material to feel the way that they used to feel, that whole thing we mentioned before. So then we have to ask, well, how does that get made then? Who are these people? Because this isn't Samantha Fox with a bra off in the page 3 anymore. Obviously, that still happens, but the stuff that people are searching for and the stuff that you know, a website is literally millions and millions of hours of viewing in a year, it's often quite degrading, quite violent, quite extreme, hardcore material. How does it get made? Who are the people? Who are the people on the other side of that screen? And so we need to look at actually what are the links that we see to coercion and manipulation and in some cases even trafficking, where we know, my friends who work in rescuing trafficked victims from the sex trade, people being pulled out of brothels and garages in Manchester, will tell you that whilst those people are being forced to be prostitutes, they're also being photographed and filmed, and that material is then being sold on to porn sites. So I'm not saying every single video on a porn site is trafficked victim. Of course it's not. But the question remains, how was it made? We don't know most of the time. And we don't question the route to our consuming most of the time, do we? You know, it's true with our clothes as well. You might go and choose a jumper in a shop and go, oh, does it fit well? Do I like the colour? But not very often do we ask, well, I wonder how it got made. Who was the person sewing this together? And did they get paid well? And did they even get a break? And what hours are they having to work? And some of us think like that. But on the whole, most of us just go, do I like it or not? And that's how most people in our culture engage with sex and pornography. Do I like it? Does it turn me on? Am I interested in how it got here? Not particularly. And so what we've got to try and help people to do is to think and question that. You know, Folly said this. She said, didn't she, in her thing. She said, stolen water is sweet. Here's a question. Who gets robbed? Who gets robbed? If this water's so sweet, who gets robbed? Is it me? Am I being robbed, actually, from being able to experience a connection with my father who loves me because I feel so weighed down with shame and guilt and I don't even think I'm a proper Christian? So actually, I'm being robbed. I'm being robbed of a relationship that is mine to be had, but because of my this sweet water, I'm being robbed of it because along with it comes shame and guilt and brokenness. Is it my wife being robbed? Is she being robbed because actually I can't fancy her anymore? Is she being robbed? Is the person on the screen being robbed of their dignity because they're being coerced and manipulated perhaps? Or even if they're not, even if they've gone in with their eyes open and they're happily enjoying it. But actually, what we're finding, we've got people who are connected to our organisation who are spending a lot of time with performers, and they're saying, you know what we're seeing? We're seeing in people in their 40s, post-traumatic stress syndrome, because they're thinking back about the stuff that they've been doing for the last 20 years. And at the time, it seemed to make sense to them. And now they're going, how could I have done that? In the same way that your vets are questioning some of their actions, they're doing the same thing. So who's being robbed is a really important question as we read when Folly says, but stolen water is sweet, it's so sweet. Yeah, but it's also stolen. Let's ask where it came from. Who suffers? Is God robbed? Is God robbed? This beautiful thing that he gave us, sex, as a gift. Is he being robbed of that? Is sex itself being robbed and presented out of its context of commitment and love and marriage? Good question, Matt. The second thing, of course, that Folly talks about is this. She says, food eaten in secret is delicious. And we need to question that too. On our team, we have an amazing lady called Bethany. And her story is, throughout her teens and her 20s, she was pretty obsessively, compulsively using porn 3 or 4 times a day. She was a Christian. She led worship in church. She talks about how actually she would get up and lead worship on a Sunday morning just almost unable to even open her mouth because she knew the night before she'd been up till 4 o'clock in the morning watching porn online. It had taken control of her life. She's weighed down with guilt and self-hate. She, as it said in the poem there, you know, she was battered and bleeding out. It was like for her, she felt like a hypocrite. She felt like God hated her. She felt disgusting. One day, somehow, she manages to go and talk to a small group leader in a church, and she says, look, I don't think you're ever going to want to look at me again after I tell you what I'm going to tell you. Your kids, you won't want your kids to spend time with me again once I tell you what I'm about to tell you? And then she says, I've for the last 8 years, I've been looking at porn every day, 2 or 3 times a day. I'm disgusting. I know there's something wrong with me because I'm a woman. I remember sitting in a sermon where the vicar got up and he said, we're going to talk about porn today. Brilliant. Love the fact the vicar did that. But then went, but women, you need to probably just go to sleep now because this isn't for you. Don't like the fact he did that. So she thought, I am a freak then. She sat there going, I knew it. I thought I was a freak, but obviously I am a freak. And she said to this woman, I'm a freak. I'm a failure. I'm not a real Christian. God must hate me. I hate myself. But I just have to tell someone, because yesterday I was literally lying under the kitchen table crying in the fetal position because I'm just so at loss. And this woman said, that's incredible that you've told me that. You are amazing. I can't believe you did that. You are so brave, so awesome for telling me that. If anyone ever discloses anything to you, the first thing we've got to say is you are amazing for even doing that, because that was the biggest, scariest thing they've ever done. And then she said this, me too. Maybe you can't say that, but she could. And she said, me too. I've struggled with this. Together, let's start to pray. Let's start to get some professional help or some more kind of, you know, structured support. Let's take this journey together. And Bethany starts to walk out of the darkness into the light. Even though she knows Jesus, she's having to go on that journey. But you know, the part that changed everything was that she was able to break the secrecy. Because now the lies that shame had been telling her could actually be questioned by somebody who could tell her the truth. See, one of the reasons why porn will floor people, or even any sort of sexual sin can floor people, is because with it often comes secrecy, and then with secrecy comes shame. And so people hate themselves, and particularly if they've got faith, they're kind of going, wah, and there's something wrong with me. And because they've not told anyone, there's no one to say, but that's not who you are. And so causing people to question this thing of food eaten in secret is delicious is significant, isn't it? That's a massive thing that we can do. So let us just move on as we kind of begin to draw to a close. Let's begin to think a little bit about wisdom's invitation as well, just as we start to do that. And I have yacked on. But I do want us to imagine a generation that's not battered and bleeding out. I want us to imagine what it would be like if we name folly, but we don't shame the people that listen to it. You know, I want us to imagine how, whether people are churched or not churched, that they could have this mountain removed so that they can actually see and Jesus is revealed to them. One of the amazing things that folly says is, that wisdom says is, you know, leave your ways and live. Come and live in the way of insight. There's actually another kind of verse in Proverbs earlier on that I want us to look at just as we draw to a close. And you might want to mark this one as well. And it's Proverbs 4. And there's a couple of verses, and I'll read them to you. It says, because this is how I think we can leave our ways and live, how we can live a way of insight, how we can start to make our way to wisdom's house, how we can encourage others to do the same. It says, guard your heart above all else, for it determines the course of life. You probably know that bit. Avoid all perverse talk. Stay away from corrupt speech. Look straight ahead and fix your eyes on what lies before you. Mark out a straight path for your feet. Stay on the safe path. Don't get sidetracked. Keep your feet from following evil. There's a few real basic things here that I just want to quickly unpack for us. And I'm not going to spend ages talking about each one, but if you take notes, you know, you've just got some points here that you can kind of bullet point. The first one is this idea of guard your heart. Obviously, in scripture, the heart is commonly seen as the seat of our emotions and our desires. And so, particularly as we think about a kind of oversexed generation, that funny phrase that has been put in the title of this workshop, you know, what we've got to recognize is that at the seat of that is their heart. So how do we kind of help people guard their heart? Well, part of guarding your heart is to actually know when you are emotionally vulnerable. You know, one of the things that I see time and time again, and one of the ways that we help people who are kind of journeying from kind of feeling trapped by porn into freedom, is helping them to identify their vulnerabilities, knowing when they're vulnerable. And some of that's about environments and times and places where they're more vulnerable. Maybe if they're on their own, if they're in a hotel or something, or if their wife's gone to bed or whatever. They're kind of, you know, environmental vulnerabilities that you can try and spot. But actually also there's emotional vulnerabilities. So often people end up making foolish decisions not based just on the enticement that's before them, but actually on the emotional vulnerability that they feel. They're lonely, they're stressed, they're angry, they've had an argument with someone, they've failed at work, they feel like they've had a bad week at the office, they've had a bad report of some kind. And actually, in those times of emotional vulnerability, as humans, often what we do is we reach out to something to make us feel a bit better. Maybe for you, it might be a glass of wine or an extra big bar of chocolate. For some people, it's a porn site, or maybe it's their boyfriend, girlfriend, who they know actually they will probably end up sleeping with tonight. And one of the ways that we can guard our hearts is that we've got to acknowledge when we get vulnerable. And help people spot that and talk about that and recognize that. And that's a bit like, you know, when people try and diet and they kind of do a diet calendar or whatever and go, you know, write down everything you've eaten. And then you realize actually you had about 10 sneaky biscuits that you'd totally forgotten about. Sometimes even just the act of noticing is a really important thing in how we guard our hearts. Because what we start to do is we can say to people, okay, let's look at the last time you messed up in an area sexually. What came before it emotionally? What was it? Because next time you feel that emotion, we need to find another way that you can deal with it. And so helping people look at that is really important. The next bit of that Proverbs verse talks about this, doesn't it? It talks about stay away from corrupt speech. And I think in our context, I'd like to kind of talk about the kind of corrupt speech that we speak to ourselves. The kind of distorted thinking and conversations that we have. And that can be all sorts of different things that we might say to ourselves, like, you know, well, I'm only doing this. I could be doing that, but I'm only doing this. Where we actually kind of, you know, compare it to something else. One of our team talks about when you speed, when you're driving along, we're really good at kind of coming up with reasons to kind of justify our actions. Sometimes it's like, well, if I wasn't stuck behind that learner for the last 20 minutes, I wouldn't be speeding now, you know, and you're blaming someone else actually for what you're doing. Sometimes you're going, well, at least I'm not going 110 like that person who's just overtaken me in the fast lane is going. So we kind of just compare ourselves to someone else, you know, and we can do that as well when it comes to this stuff. You know, maybe if my wife had sex with me more often, I wouldn't have to even be thinking about some of this stuff. But we're blaming someone else. Or maybe the issue is that actually, you know, it's not that big a deal. You know, I'm only doing this. So we try to kind of minimize the impact that it's going to have. And there's therapists would call this cognitive distortion. And it's common in all kinds of dependent behavior, where we have often the same excuses that we give ourselves time and time again. And so when Proverbs tells us to, you know, be cautious of corrupt speech, that counts the speech that we give ourselves. And you will know your own self scripts that you tell yourselves normally before you mess up. The way that you justify, the way you minimize, the way maybe you blame others. And we've got to learn to spot when we've started saying that stuff to ourselves and say, no, I've got to stay away from that. That's when we've got to take our thoughts captive. And we've got to teach others to do the same. You know, that's not a kind of, again, you know, a non-Christian needs to understand that as well as a Christian, don't they? But this is what walking in wisdom and insight can look like. Final thing to kind of talk about here. There's a couple of others in this verse that we could look at. You know, we could talk about the whole idea of marking your path and staying on a safe path. And that implies the understanding that there are some routes that we can take that lead one way and some routes that lead another way. And so, again, sometimes it's just helping people think through what will happen next. What will happen next? I remember sitting with a guy and talking to him. And actually, again, he worked for a church, actually. And he started to tell me how he'd begun looking at porn at the church office when he was on his own. And I said to him, what would happen next? What would happen if you got caught? And he said, well, I don't know for sure, but I'd probably lose my job. Okay, so then what happens next? Well, I'd have to tell my wife. I haven't told my wife about this stuff. And, you know, I've just lost my job. I would have to tell my wife, and I don't know what that would mean. And, okay, so what would happen next? Well, I'd probably have to explain to my kids why I don't have that job anymore. So now I'm having this conversation with my kids about, maybe not immediately, but at some point in my life, I'm going to have to tell them that's what happened. And the incredible thing is, this intelligent man had never even thought that through to that point. And sometimes we've just got to mark out the path in front of us, both negative and positive. And we've got to go, you know, if I continue in this direction, where does it lead? Because what the guests of folly do not know is that in our house is the realm of death. Destruction is where it leads. In our relationships, in our life, maybe even in our calling is where it can lead. But there is this final bit, which is great. And this is where we'll kind of come to a bit of an end here, which is that it says, doesn't it, you know, look straight ahead, fix your eyes on what lies ahead. And this is when we think about wisdom, you know, she's calling to people to something beautiful, something better, to something wonderful. She's saying, I've prepared something amazing. Part of what we do, part of how we help this generation that is listening to folly is that we've got to help them hear wisdom's invitation. We've got to say, fix your eyes on this. Now, it might be a bit more of a journey to get there, but fix your eyes on this. Fix your eyes on this better thing. And for those that are struggling in this area, that might be, again, something you do very deliberately. You know, what am I called to? What are the things that I value? What do I risk losing? Well, I'm going to write those down, and I'm going to write the things, the dreams that I have and the things that I want my life to be. I want to be this kind of husband or wife. I want to be this kind of parent. I want to be, and maybe you're not even married yet, but you're going, this is what I want to be. This is what I'm heading for. I want to be walking in what God has called me to do. And that's what this looks like. And so we start to actually write that down and visualize it and understand it. And that's how we fix our eyes on what's ahead. We have to be deliberate about it. We have to name it. Because if we don't name the wisdom, the outcome, as well as naming the problem, then we're missing it. You know, so that again is another way that we could sit down with people if you're trying to help people and just say, let's talk about what you want your life to look like. Let's fix our eyes on that. Let's talk about how we can get there. Let's talk about what that can mean. And so I am aware that time has ended, so I am going to stop rather than go into another whole thing here. But The poem that Joshua has written, the spoken word piece, ends with this idea, doesn't it? He says, I have a future and it's beautiful and you're not in it. That's what he's saying to Porn. I just love us, just for a second, and we're not going to spend ages on it, just for 10 seconds, I'd love us to prophesy those very words. I don't know what that means to you in your world, in your theology, but I'd love you just to kind of almost speak those words out. And as you do so, think about maybe the people you know. Maybe it's this generation that are so immersed in folly and the lies and the temptation that they can't even see it. Maybe it's individuals you're thinking of specifically. Maybe it's in your own life. And what we want to say is, there is a future. And it is beautiful. And porn's not in it. Can we just do that? There is a future, and it's beautiful, and porn's not in it. Why don't you just close your eyes for a moment? Think of a person, think of a generation, think of a situation. Think of a relationship. And together in a moment, I'll count us in, but together we're going to say, there is a future, a banquet that has been prepared. There is a future, and it is beautiful. And porn is not in it. Brokenness is not in it. So we'll just say, you're not in it. There is a future. It is beautiful, and you're not in it. On three. One, two, three. There is a future. It is beautiful, and you're not in it. Father God, I just pray for the people here who represent so many lives, people that know you, people who don't know you, communities that right now are immersed in folly, who are hearing folly cry out to them every day. Lord, we want to be wisdom shout to those people. Show us how we can name folly for what it is, but also show us how we can get better at revealing the beauty of wisdom's invitation, of your invitation. And so we ask that in your name. Amen. We're Naked Truth. We're here just for today, but we do have a stand with stuff about all the work we do, stuff in schools. We work with wives and partners of those that struggle with porn. We work we're online in confidential support groups for people who are struggling with porn as well. We also, just this week, have launched a mentoring program for young people that want to quit porn, Christian young people, called Refresh. Just come and ask us about that, and we'll tell you all about it if you want to know more, but I'm going to stop.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to check out message.org.uk to find out how you can support or even get involved with one of our teams.